Oh, yes, my friends. It's the Show and Sleeve Show.
Take my hat, take my coat, take my gloves, I'll take a cup. Take my money, but I'm begging, please don't take my suit. Take my house, take my clothes, take my wife, lighten up my load. Take my feet, you can take my toes, but please don't take my suit.
From the downtowniest part of New York City, the city that never sleeps, the city that never weeps, the city where nothing keeps. Coming to you live on WCJD 90.2, New York, high atop the Empire State Building.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Oh, yes, thank you. Thank you. Don't stop. Don't. I say this. Oh, from the applause of the great crowd to some frog-drenched swamp in Mississippi. I always like those old shows, I suppose even the new shows, when some host comes waltzing out and the crowd is applauding as they are paid to do or feel obligated to do, or simply because they're so bored of having done nothing for so long waiting for the show. And then the host plays with their applause. They get used to that. They raise it up, they become like conductors of their own applause. It's very hokey and jokey. It's also a sign that you've been around for a while. Seems like only the older, more respected much too loud pond. Ponds aren't very often too loud, but today our pond is too loud. We've never got anywhere and anyone ever said, what a too loud pond. What a screamingly loud pond. Who turned up the volume on this pond? But pond should be louder. That's why they're so underrated. If only they would clamor. They would babble, even a little babble. A little brook-like babble. You would be much more drawn to ponds. As it is, they're considered quite close to the swamp. Almost a swamp is what people think when they say pond. And so it is the next year. It is the new year. It is 2013. I'm sure most of the older listeners, and maybe most of the listeners are older, maybe all of my listeners then, might have the feeling that I have, which is that I hardly remember 2009 or 10 or 11, and all of a sudden they bowl another one down the alley. That's sort of my main senses as the year passes. I feel as though 2012, has that even arrived yet? I didn't quite even get it on. I didn't even bring it around, get my arm in, quite. I didn't take my first 2012 step, and now, 2013, increasingly, it feels to be the future. I have my tea here, my Nola cup, and a too loud pond, still too loud. And I apologize for sending out the incorrect message that the show would not be on tonight. I did not think I would make it back in time. And then, of course, time made it back in for me. I often don't think I'm making wherever I'm supposed to go on time. It's a condition of not knowing what time it is and always feeling late. And never quite remembering what one's supposed to be doing. So even though I've known, and I know that I do this Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Clutch and Wiggle Radio Empire Network, I do have a way of forgetting. I can completely not be remembering it at 8 o'clock at night, and then suddenly, what am I doing? Not prepared. I often don't think at all about it, and I don't, that's not to put it down or not to say it's not important to me, but that what I want it to be is largely not very prepared. I like to have a prepared thing or two, but even those things are not meant to be done with too much thought. So a walk. This evening we have a walk in the snowstorm. And that's, I go out without knowing what I will say. Sometimes I go out walking. I walk every day. So, and sometimes I bring the recorder. But I will occasionally go out walking with the recorder and record nothing. And then after some time, I think my arm is hurting. Why, you know? And then I'll look down and there the recorder is sticking there, hurting my arm. Like my arm is the prop for some audio recording bird. A small bird box on the end of my wrist. Now, of course, as the legendary ball dropped near the legendary Roy Harter's place of work in Times Square, a place that I visited, incidentally, a place, Roy Harter's studio, Skinny Man Studio, skinnyman.com. His office is positioned in such a beautiful way that you can go out. You have to hop over some kind of radiator, then you're out on a balcony. Dangerous child. Children would love this balcony. It's so dangerous feeling. And it seems to me that you're almost below some enormous clock that no one should get close to except the clockmaker and God. But there you are. Besides or below an enormous clock in the free, high New York air, looking out over Times Square. And there it was, the famous ball that drops. And you're up close to it and it looks so small. You're trying to figure out, now why does that represent the passing of a year? This ball is glittering, strange, small ball falling downward. It should rise up and disappear into the sky, explode. Explode with memories and photographs. That's what it should be, a rocket full of memories. And all the memories burn as they fall. Instead, you see this ball falling down and it's like a vague disco dance is coming to an end. My tea is much too hot, but I'm desperately interested in drinking it. Now, I had a thought. It's very cold, very cold. And when it's cold here, I suppose it's cold all places, or colder than it normally would be, and so we all might say it's cold. And I was off in the car today driving, and was 5 degrees, and I saw against the mountains a great heavy white wave. All along the mountains, the white curtain that I normally would instantly say that is snow. The snow is falling, but the weather forecast was for sunny skies and no snow. And so I wondered whether this was fog. Could there be fog in such cold air? Can fog exist in frigid air? Or is that not possible? What I imagined was if there was a fog, all the water crystals would instantly turn to ice and fall back to the ground. And then I had this wonderful thought. I couldn't stop thinking about this as I walked around then after in the afternoon, and it was still very cold. I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if on very cold days those long scarf-white breaths of ours, those long escaping inside breaths, if as they escaped from our mouths and formed those scarves, if they froze, all the water crystals froze and then fell to the ground like a crashing zeppelin. And so everywhere you went, people would be walking around with their breaths crashing to the ground, shooting out and then crashing like the zeppelin. And these small little noises, little angel wing noises, psh, psh, psh. All of our breaths, our frozen breaths. And if you wanted to, you could reach out and your own breath would fall right into your hands. You could carry it around with you, throw it at your friend. Imagine if you could go out breath throwing. Don't throw that breath at me. Don't, I said, don't throw your breath. Stop it. You throw it at cars, your enemies. What a great way to treat your enemy, throwing your breath at them. How insulting. And then fun, too, for children to throw harmless scarves of breath. One breath crashing into one boy's face, the other boy's breath into the other. And so I don't know if fog can exist on very cold days. And I still wonder whether there is some truth to the idea of the breath freezing as it emerges, the water particles. I mean, I'm sure, I don't want to break the spell, so I won't go any further, but that was a great wonder of mine today. I kept picturing all these different breath shapes. I kept wondering as I exhaled, I wonder what that would look like, that one. That small. And then it seemed that each breath had its own small personality. This thin, angry breath that emerged. This big, loud, wide breath. I checked. T-check. Most radio personalities do mic checks. I do T checks. Check the T. So we have two pieces tonight. One is a walk that I did in the snowstorm. I don't know if I mentioned that it's snowing out. You can hear it there on the snow hitting the microphone. Little sounds, as breath sounds, we'll say. And then a piece by Sean that may never air on public radio, but he composed for public radio. But under a certain different auspice. That's a piece on the road that we live near here. A very unique and particular road. It's one of the only roads of its kind in the country. It's 9 miles long. He runs it, I walk it. No one lives on it. It's a dirt road. A book has been written about it. A poem has been written about it. And Sean wanted to do a story about it, which is not... It's not a typical public radio subject, at least not at the level of radio that he's on. But he wanted to, and they tentatively agreed at least to listen to whatever he wanted to put together, and he did, and it's a bit odd. I'll say that, it's a bit odd. It's a story about a road. He's trying to describe a road, a very old road, by talking about the radio show he's listening to while he runs down said road. But that idea occurred to him, and so he tried to make it work. Does it work? We may never know. We'll listen to that tonight. And Paul Potts also suggested that we listen to Alvin, I'm not going to say his last name right, Lucia. Alvin Lucia's I'm Sitting in a Room, which I should describe, but I may not. We'll see if we get to that. I don't know that we will. I'm going to work on my tea, and while I do that, we shall all listen to the Goldcart Mountaintop Queens directory. By guided by voices.
Cold hands touching my face. Don't hide, the snake can see you. Old friends you might not remember, fading away from you. The Gold Heart Mountaintop Queen Directory. The Gold Heart Mountaintop Queen Directory. And we looked, and we passed through the hallway. Shatterproof glass.
She runs through the night as if nobody cares. She screams and she cries and ignores all the stares. She wants me to come, but I'm never going there. The Gold Heart Mountaintop Queen.
And that was a song by Guided by Voices. Let's all pause and have a breath mint. Now, breath mint, breaths that fall to the earth, will of course be perhaps delicacies in some countries. Perhaps we could export them in large bags and send them over by balloon. That's the only way breaths will go, by balloon. Sorry, I just got a little message on the phone about a mouse that has passed away. So let us spend a moment. You don't have to. You may despise mice. But this was a pet mouse of someone. His name was Jerry, and he has passed away. Goodbye, Jerry. You were a mouse, and yet you were loved. I can't remember if I played a Thelonious Monk last week, did I? I think I must have. Let us go, just for now. Listen to Sean's Sandwich Knot Road story and return, talk a bit more. If you have any questions, you can type them in the chat. You can send me a tweet or an email, showandsleeves@yahoo.com. That same name at Facebook and Twitter. Some people have preferences. I don't, they want to send a message only in the way that they like. They're comfortable. They have a pair of shoes in a way. Twitter is my pair of shoes. I only like to use that. I have to cough, so here's Sean's piece. Does it work? I don't know. It's peculiar, though.
And so I was running along an old road, in new shoes, over fresh snow, listening to an old radio show about an old writer who had just died, but long ago.
And that show is about Jack Kerouac, and if you don't know who Kerouac was, he died today.
That's storytelling radio pioneer Gene Shepherd, talking near the end of October 1969. The road I was on was Sandwich Notch Road, a rickety 9-mile waltz of mostly dirt that wanders up and down and left and right in the swinging manner of a kite over the mountains that lie between Campton and Sandwich.
But Kerouac was primarily a digger, a true digger. Now, what we call a digger today is a person who really digs himself and his friends, whereas Kerouac was a guy who dug just everything. He dug the climate, he dug the landscape, he dug the sky.
He would have dug the road I was on, an old shipwreck of a road, an old fallen-down tree of a road. In its heyday, in the 1800s, there were 300 families that lived here, along the main stretch where it really is. There's no one now, and all that remains of the people who once lived here are the stones they moved. There are dug cellars and rock walls. Their gravestones dealt to the high, hidden groves just off the road. There's the pulpit rock, a massive obelisk upon which Reverend Joseph Meader used to stand above his Quaker congregation, his voice rolling off the cliffs. There's even a sign inscribed on a rock that advertises a general store ahead.
P. Wentworth, 6 miles, 1838.
And whenever I see it, I am suddenly heading toward P. Wentworth's general store, forever 6 miles ahead and 175 years in the past.
Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying to you that Kerouac was a great novelist, rather. I am saying this, though, about him, that I think that what he said is a thing that hasn't been said by many people who wrote in America. He wrote about the land, the country.
In 1973, New Hampshire writer Elizabeth Yeats wrote a book about the land. Kerouac had Route 6. Yeats had Sandwich Notch Road. Her book, The Road Through Sandwich Notch, helped the road acquire an exotic status as a protected part of the national forest.
Today, most people write almost exclusively about themselves, whereas Kerouac, on the other hand, was a sort of a digging, totally naive, open, man, ain't it great to be alive type writer, which is quite rare today.
Kerouac used the glass of the land to find his way. A gnarled tree in front of a farmhouse told the first part of the story of the family who lived there. Shepard's compass was time. He was a fisherman and a pilot, and he both cast into and flew over the river of time. He liked to tell stories of his childhood. He liked to imagine archaeologists from the future sifting through a mysterious rubble of 8-track tapes and disposable, eternal silverware.
And one night I came in and there was a letter there and a package. And it was the manuscript, not really the manuscript, but the galley copy of On the Road. And there was a note in it from Kerouac. And it said, I want you to read this. I think you might dig it. And incidentally, you're one of the characters in the novel. So I read it, and I immediately, this was before it came out, I recognized it for what it was.
As fellow travelers of the incantation, Shepard and Kerouac cut themselves on the long riff and the Hail Mary of improvisation. Pure waiting air for Shepard, blank teletype paper for Kerouac. But what drew them close was a natural way of seeing. For as fancy as both could be, they were both primitives. Like children, they were primarily beholders.
So, in America, when the sun goes down, and I sit on the old broken-down river pier watching the long, long skies over New Jersey, and sense all that raw land that rolls in one unbelievable huge bulge over to the west coast...
Anyone who explores this road will end up hip-deep in time, swimming in the land. There is no who, there is no what, there is only where. There is only when. There is time and the land, and the only way to see it is to behold it. To reframe a quote from the writer William Gass, this road has been abandoned, but it has been abandoned to beauty. It is no longer a road. It is itself. For NHPR, I'm Sean Hurley.
And on the road map was one long red line. Route 6, that led from the tip of Cape Cod to Ely, Nevada, and there dipped down to Los Angeles. I'll just stay on 6 all the way to Ely, I said to myself, and I confidently started. To get to 6, I had to go up the Bear Mountain, filled with dreams of what I'd do in Chicago. I took the 7th Avenue.
So we have a piece where Sean runs down the snowy road, and then later on a piece where I walk in the snowy forest. Snow, 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 snow. So they were giving him a bit of room. They were... at the public radio station. They wanted to give him a little room, a little rope, see what happened, see if he tied himself in knots, see if he hung himself out to dry, and we'll see if he just ended up with an old rope in his hand. But I do know he enjoyed putting it together. Uncertain as he was throughout the whole thing. He was interested, I think, in trying to tell a story in an indirect way, not to go directly upon something, not to go directly to the man or woman and interview them about the thing that they did, but to go around them, to examine their clothing, the cups they touched, their footprints. Why not? Why not try? Maybe it doesn't work, but why not try? What else? I quite enjoy not preparing. Have I ever said that? Another great possible unpreparer was that Gene Shepherd in that piece. I was the first to listen to Gene, and then Sean after me. I told him he should. And in fact, I first learned of Gene Shepherd after 3 or 4 years of doing Atoms, Motion, and Void. Before I did Radio Ghost, someone told me, they said that the Atoms, Motion, and the Void show reminded them of two people, Joe Frank and Gene Shepherd, and then I got a flurry of emails from different people saying, have you listened to Joe Frank? Have you listened to Gene Shepherd? And I didn't, and hadn't. I still haven't listened to Joe Frank. I wasn't very interested. Not because I didn't think I would dislike it. I thought I would probably like it, but I don't like similars. I don't want to know what I look like, who is like me, who speaks like me, who tells the same kinds of jokes. It's too striking sometimes. Now, the good thing is, listening to Gene Shepherd, I see no similarity at all, except in a kind of style of reflecting on small matters in a perhaps overbearing sort of way, taking something tiny the way that you sit at the dinner table and going into it. That's not any different than many filmmakers, comedians, artists of any kind, writers, they all do that. Go into a small thing and expand it, open it up. Nicholson Baker is a great one for that. Now, what you find when you go in, that's probably the only difference. You could have all these different micro-investigators go into the same dinner and find great truths, different great truths that the others did not see. And some would be mind-blowing truths, and some would be amusing, some would be ridiculous, some would not even be accurate, but might be thoughtful, striking, possible, or possible in a different setting. But I do heartily recommend, if you like radio, listen to Gene Shepherd. You can go to iTunes. There is someone who puts up all the Gene Shepherd shows, and there are thousands of them. The podcast, the Gene Shepherd podcast, there's two, I think, but the one that I mostly use is called the Brass Figlagee, which name comes from a sort of make-believe award that Shepherd would pretend to give out to any of his callers who might be able, but he didn't have any callers, to anyone who would guess the name of a certain president. He liked to challenge his listeners often, and then he would never take any calls about what the answer might be. Does anyone know, he would say, what president inspired the teddy bear? The first person who knows will get a brass figlagee with bronze oak palm leaves, something like that. The whole way, a whole long, silly list of what that prize was. But if you like radio, I would say listen to Gene Shepherd. It's a very beautiful, strange show, and you get to know this person. He's not a completely lovely person. And he's not completely right about everything. He's not. But you don't mind. After a certain point, it's not that. It's not that you love him, but you love the adventure he takes you on, the way he thinks about things. He's got a great mind for thinking about things, and John says he likes to think about things from the position of time. And that's true in a way. He likes to cast back to his childhood. He tells stories from his childhood, stories from his army days. He liked to think about the future. What will the people of the future think about us now? Of course, I didn't even mention that Gene Shepherd is the fellow who wrote the now famous Christmas perennial favorite, The Christmas Story, A Christmas Story. He narrates it and he's in it and he wrote it. And it seems to be based on certain adventures from his own life, but he regularly claimed that the stories that he told about his childhood were purely fictional. Purely fictional. But he had a way of being tricky. But so he first got his big start. I don't even know when it was, the 40s or 50s, but he did an all-night talk show from 12 or 1 to 5 or 6 in the morning. He just talked. He rarely had anything except him talking. He might play a little music. He didn't take calls. He just went and went and went. And he had that ability. And it terrified most of the other radio talk show hosts around, because they lived in a safer world of callers and guests and music. So they would only have to be free talking for a minute or two, and even that would be controlled. You would know I'm introducing President Kennedy's chief of staff, who was doing this, and that I'm playing this bit of music. So they would always know what they'd be talking about. But Gene, you can often hear, I think he prepared many of his shows, or he had some idea, and he did sometimes claim that he worked hard at it. But sometimes his shows would begin, he sings, and he'll hit the table by George, I don't, and he talks to his technician. He always liked to have a technician, his audio person. He liked to use them as his audience. And so you can sometimes hear him request. He'll say, I can't remember any of their names. He'd say, John, your job is to look at me during the show. Don't look down at the lights. Don't fiddle with the knobs. Just stare at me. And Shepherd also wrote what he called novels, but which were just collections of short stories. I've read one of them. And he is a tremendously good writer. He's an overwriter. But he simply needed a better editor. But it's hard to know whether anyone could stand up to him. He was large and small in some very interesting way. It's hard to describe. And he apparently never turned off. So even when he was not on the radio, anyone who was near him, he would just regale them with stories. And apparently not on the radio, it wasn't as interesting. And he was a stage performer. He did what he did on the radio, he would do it on stage on the weekends. At different colleges, he would tell stories, perhaps a bit more prepared, stories he was familiar with. but there are interesting odd reports about these performances, that he seemed to strain more for the audience's approval than certain watchers would have preferred. So he was too eager, too needful of their approval. And that's not something you hear on the air. It may be something you see in someone's face, in their eyes, or the way their body moves. But you can't hear it. You just listen. So it seems in the final way, even though he disavowed radio later on, or thought of it as a stepping stone towards whatever medium he thought he should be or was intended, which perhaps was film. Radio is really his greatest contribution. It was where he lived best. He just couldn't quite allow it. It was too slight. He was not only a showman. He liked to think of himself as someone in show business. And whenever he spoke of any artist in the literary world, he was very disdainful. He did not like Philip Roth or John Updike or any Norman Mailer. He did like Kerouac. He did not like any of the privileged tennis sweater style of New York writers. The very smart, the very educated, the very upper class kinds of popular, sophisticated literary writers. And his dislike almost seemed a type of envy. Because it's easy to dislike anyone for anything. You can dislike Philip Roth for this reason, that reason, or John Updike. But it is difficult to dislike them and not give them some credit. Because regardless of your feeling of their themes or the way they carried it off, all brilliant writers, Norman Mailer, but he would have washed the world of them, invalidated them, cancelled them right out, and secretly, you suspect, placed himself in there. He stopped his regular broadcasting in 1977, I believe. And in those last later years, there is a sense of grandiosity. He laughs too hard at his own jokes, or he'll often come out with a very good line about something, but then he'll note it. Note his own cleverness, and it's with too much pleasure. Say, oh, this is that, and that is this. My goodness, that's a really wonderful thing I've just said. And then he'll laugh. What a wonderful... Someone write that down. And there's a joshing quality to those remarks, but at the same time you feel he's writing it down so that it doesn't get lost, which is also fine, but it's a grandiosity that seemed there. Part of his frustration, because radio, especially the radio that he did, there were no awards for it. No one respected it. It was hard to measure what made it good or bad. He didn't exactly have any competition. So he was brilliant and alone and cultivated a very unique storytelling performance style of radio. And at the end of the day, it was as though nobody had paid any attention to him, and he was bitter about that. And I think he yearned to be a part of some better organized artistic framework, one with awards, one with clear competition, one that came with reviews in the New York Times, Why don't we move on? A little walk in the snowstorm. Then we'll be back. There's no set time limit this evening. It's strange, because I was late and thought I would not make it. The moment I started, I had no sense that it should go for an hour. So wherever we end is wherever we end. So if it goes 2 hours, it does. If it's an hour and a half, it's that we shall go until we stop by natural selection. So here is a recent walk in the snow. People don't realize this, but walking is not like the beating of the heart. It's voluntary. You have to issue an order, an executive command. It can feel as automatic as the heartbeat or as breathing. And breathing itself is in a tricky territory because we can, more or less, we have some wiggle room with breathing. We can bring it in, we can push it out, we can huff and puff, we can hold our breaths. But behind all that is a automatic machine controlling it all. It's as though it were a marionette whose strings we can ply and push and pull and make the puppet's hands go up and down, but really, high above, a set of crossed strings and some Geppetto. Right, left, right, left, right, left. And I assume inside there is a shorthand that issues a whole series of commands, the complicated process of moving the right leg, that when you're very young, as you're first learning, you have to do each thing in turn until you can coordinate it all together. Lean forward, tip the hip, lift the foot, push off, bend the knee, contract this muscle, expand that, set the foot, prepare for touchdown. It is like milk out. It is like milk. It is the ice box, and it is like milk. Right, left, right, left. A whole army of commands. I'm certain a physiologist would be only too happy to let us all know that over 16,000 different micro announcements are made throughout the body to make a single toe move. That over 18 million different things happen in the course of a single completed step. I never believed those things. I would say it's 7 or 8 foot, knee, hip, arm, even the head. The head likes to swing around as you walk, you know. It's kind of... Perhaps how they figured out the gyro for this segue. They watched the human head as it bobbed and balanced in the wake of all this blow motion. Sometimes I try to keep my head perfectly still as I move. I try simply to achieve the illusion of floating. Why not? It's not something I spend a lot of time doing. Don't think that I'm always out here attempting to float. The old balloon head's out. He's trying to float his head down the avenue again. Look at him. Strange old positions. Missed the path. One inconvenient bit of noticing will also sometimes take place. An inconvenient bit of noticing related to the beating of the heart. If you, for example, walk very quickly somewhere and then come to a fast halt, you stop. Perhaps a noise has caught your attention. You're listening, and all of a sudden you notice that your ridiculous, your deeply silly heartbeat is shaking your entire body very subtly, as though someone were hitting you on the back with a rubber mallet. Not hard, but just enough to joggle your whole body. And you think, well, I don't want to be joggling about like that. What am I, some sort of shaky device? You may try to compensate. Perhaps the movement is a sudden right to left. You can build into your body a sudden left to right. Try to zero it out and once again achieve the old balloon boy look. The old floater. It doesn't work. But sometimes our bodies rise up and disturb us in their very normal way, as though we wish we were more mechanical, more machine-like. We could rid ourselves of the little shakes and tremors of being. It's odd that this should be the sound of water. I wonder if there are any of people of the snow, people who have snow as part of their life, who don't have, as the Eskimos do, multiple meanings for snow, but simply call it water. It's a lot of water out today. I've got to go shovel the water. It just didn't bother coming up with anything else. So when it rains, water is falling. They go swimming in the water. Great waves of water, glass of water. Shovel the water. You get the point, I'm sure. Should I belabor it? I'm a great, great belaborer. It's a bad habit of mine. I am almost constitutionally unable to not belabor. I must belabor. Ladies and gentlemen, may I belabor that point? I'm even belaboring this belaborment. That is the secret to my success. What success, you wonder? Well, that's my secret. There's a secret to my success, and then again, my success is a secret. What is it, old tree? of all the forms of life that I could possibly exchange time with, whose being I would like to enter, I may be curious to make a soul's acquaintance with the tree. I suppose it would be nice to be a dog and run around and be that happy, or a cat, or a mouse in the walls, or a tiger. And some interested in the vegetable part of the world might pick flower, but I would like to be a tree, not even an old tree, any tree. Just to stand in one place and be so satisfied. Who stands anywhere so satisfied as a tree? It's grammatically incorrect, but I was feeling poetic. Beginning to edge into belaborment again. But trees are like rocks that came alive. Trees and rocks are similar and very similar in at some grain of being. There's definite atomic similarity in their mood and atmosphere, and yet a shocking difference in the expansiveness of the life force. Which is to agree with the many people who say that rocks are alive. They are alive. Now they don't talk, and they don't walk, and their livingness is alien to our sense of livingness to a degree along the commute that could be made toward void. And along that commute you would come upon tree somewhere, and then further along rock, and then further along it's hard to say. My grasp of universal materials is quite limited. But alive in what sense? Well, it is full of similar things, similar atomic things that are all bouncing around, you just can't see. There's a glittering array inside every stone of life, of a very primitive kind. There's no personality, and that's one thing that's a problem for us, is we often confuse personality with living, with what is living, in the same way that we confuse personality and identity with who we are. Who are you? I am this thing. I had a thought about art today. It just was reminded of for some reason. I had a friend who used to pretend to be someone that he wasn't. He changed himself around in a certain way. And he performed. He was an actor. And he was convincing enough that people believed him to be this other person. And whenever they found out that he was not this other person, this invention. They would say, oh, I thought this other character was real. The character, I thought it was real. And he never said anything about this, but he told me once that it wasn't the way that he thought of it. It was real. The other character was as real as he was, and was as real as, for example, a drawing. You could look at a drawing, and a drawing is real. It's something on a piece of paper, a rendering of some kind, a sketch of somebody. And it's not really important whether it's a drawing of a bridge or a real bridge. They are both real. And what is more important is whether you believe the drawing. We can expand that back into, let's think, and it's always very easy, very energizing to think of abstract expressionism or any kind of modern art, some kind of modern art that you've seen that you don't relate to, an enormous wall of colored plates. You look at such things and you wonder, is this art? And I think I realize that the question you're actually asking yourself when you look at things that challenge you, you're wondering to yourself, mostly, do I believe in this? Not whether it's real art or not, but do you believe in it? And that is an important distinction, not whether it's real or not real, not whether it's good or not good, but whether you believe in it. And that is a different and more easily accessible perhaps emotional comment. Believing things has a funny way of allowing its character to come through in an emotional way. So it's easier to access. I'm lost now in the woods. I should have brought a light. But I always say it. So rarely bring one. Because then the batteries are always out. And I think I have to bring batteries. And then I have a terrible battery habit. I don't know what this is, but I can't throw batteries away. I don't know what they are anymore. They seem like poison or something, so I tend to take batteries out of old things and stick them back in the box with the rest of the good batteries. So who knows what I've got? I wander around with a pocket full of old batteries. One of them's good. I'm really lost right now. Need some old batteries. Why do I do that? With the batteries. And why do I come out without light and without batteries? And why do I put the bad batteries in with the good? Lost. Lost again. Must love to be lost. Always finding it. Always finding. I say it's disagreeable, but there's something about it agreeable to me. I think what I like about being lost is the small temporary promise of arriving in a complete elsewhere, of becoming another in another place, as though I won't be able to make it home and I'll move on to some next place, another world. Here's a question that just came to mind. How old were you when you found out?
Once upon a blackbird, in a dark and stormy night, I heard the rattle of the shatter of the breaking of your heart. Beat and breathe, but the whole world drowned in sea. Beat and breathe, but the whole world drowned in sea.
That song there, if I remember right, was a part of the original Whisper, Pray, Make Room song medley. There were three or four or five other songs that didn't make the final cut, that themselves had to be cut. That was one. And so I noticed it and threw it in. That's an old song too. Very old. 10-15 years old. It's one of those songs I started long ago, then discovered and then finished. Let us say here now, if you have anything you would like me to play, sounds or songs, feel free to send them along. I don't think this evening I'll play the elven Lucia. I think that needs more. For proper space, better introduction, not something tagged at the end. I haven't fully absorbed it myself, so. But if you want, you could look it up. Elven Lucia, L-U-C-I-E-R. And it's a piece, I think, from the late 60s called I'm Sitting in a Room. And it's very promising in an interesting way. I haven't fully, as I said, gone into it. I wasn't aware how long that walk was. Quite a long walk. I need to edit those down. They should be much shorter. Ah, well. Learn and learn and learn and learn and live. And learn and learn. Learning's very hard. Very tricky to learn. Who wants to learn? We want to be done with it. We'd like to know and be done. Because learning involves change. We don't like that. Change an idea? Pity me. Sad me to change a thought. Tragic. It is hard. One thing that I find troubling and preposterous is the adherence to an idea that ideas themselves or thoughts or opinions, you can see this best in the political world, that they should remain fixed and that they, in their fixity, they are true, that they are iron. So on. Fellow has an idea about the way the economy goes, and it's his thought, it's his opinion, an idea, and he can have no growth from it. It has to be iron. And if he moves off it, everyone points. You've changed your mind. We should always, that should be the movement that we applaud, not the rigidity that we know to be a lie. Changelessness and an inability to move from a position about a position is a terrible weakness. Should always be flip-flopping this way and that, this way and that. With ever broader reasons for doing so. Whenever you change your mind, it's for a broader, better reason. And you can even change your mind back to the original spot, but you will do so with a broader, better reason. This reminds me of that very interesting and entertaining battle of wits in The Princess Bride between Wallace Shawn. Character's name, I think, was Vicini, and Cary Elwes, who played the Dread Pirate Roberts. Dread Pirate Roberts had defeated Inigo Montoya, Mandy Patinkin, and Andre the Giant, who was named Fezzik. He defeated Mandy Patinkin with a sword and defeated Fezzik, and then he went on to Wallace Shawn, and they had a battle of wits, and it involved two glasses of wine, one with poison, and Vicini, Wallace Shawn's challenge was to divine whether the glass before him was the one that the man in black had put poison in. And so he erected arguments on both sides. You'd know I am not a smart man. You'd know I am a logical person. Therefore, you would not put the poison in my glass. But knowing this, you would not put poison in your glass. Back and forth, ever broadening, ever deepening his profile of this situation. It seemed ridiculous in practice, but it is, in fact, the movement of our thought about a thing, even though he ended up dead. That's how it goes. Because both chalices are poisoned, and that may be itself the ironic truth of any of our ideas that we take sides upon. You think yes, the other person thinks no, the idea itself is poisoned, and both die, or would if one hadn't done the mithridatic thing and become immune to the poison. Well, what do we think? Shall we call it a night? Inconceivable. Inconceivable. I'd watch a whole film of Wallace Shawn being that character. I was sad when he died, terribly sad. When I watched that film the first time, I thought, inconceivable, he can't be dead. He's my most favorite. Also, I love Mandy Patinkin, and that's beautiful. There's something I did not tell you. I am not left-handed. Everyone, that film itself is entertaining because you can feel how deeply fulfilled everyone is in it. They're so happy to be doing it. Maybe they don't know what it is even. But pleasure is written all through it. Deep pleasure. Deep pleasure in the performances, deep pleasure in the colors. You don't get that in films much. The sense that everyone is enjoying themselves. That they are happy in their performance. That they're alive and well. Most of you get very controlled, very excellent technical things, but not this sense of deep joy. And it was a type of nod to the fact that it was a film. It was as though they were all saying, yes, we know this is a film, and watch us enjoy ourselves, make it. So you could see that aspect, the enjoyment. It was like a documentary secretly playing alongside the film, inside it. Secret, subjective documentary. That may be present in every film. But we may not enjoy watching it, and so we may not pay attention. All right, my friends. All right, my friends. It is tired and I am late. We say goodnight for the final time to Jerry the Mouse. And I'll see you again next week, next Wednesday, 9 p.m. right here on the Clutch and Wiggle Radio Empire. We'll listen to more things. I suppose that's all that we do. Listen. I do have a phone number. I don't remember it now. If you want to, you can call and leave me a message. And I say thank you. Thank you, Ted. And I agree, their hearts are definitely shining. Shining through. That's a good way to put it. Oh, I wish I'd said that. Oh, Ted, I wish I'd said that now. But haven't I? But it is tired, and I am late. Always merry and bright to you, my friends. Always merry and bright. It's tired.
and I'm late. The old frozen fire turn out late. Tomorrow we'll slip through town, side every turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sweep. It's tired and I'm late. Untie your candles, I just lit the skates. We're sitting in sleepless light, count dreams that we're sleeping right. But now it's time to sweep.
Hit a ball now.
It's tired and I'm late. Your frozen fire turn out late. Tomorrow we'll sleep through town, side every turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sweep.